Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit the webpage georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on critical condition when we come back. You know, we Americans hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, but when it comes to law, we're among the most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist these evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, our privacy, our property, by these powerful government agencies and multinational corporations, lobbies, and the news media. But you know, we don't have to remain helpless. The institution designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, is called the judicial power. The courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, liberties, and property, not the Congress or the political process. And did you know that the privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights, not to one who's indifferent thereto? That's because it's a fighting clause, and its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat. It cannot be claimed by an attorney or a solicitor. It's valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant in person. That's a citation from U.S. versus Johnson, and that's why I contend that we should listen more to the judges and less to the politicians and lawyers. Now, did you hear what that judge said in that statement? He said, your rights cannot be claimed by your attorney or solicitor. Your rights can only be claimed by you, the belligerent claimant in person. And if you'd like to learn more about how to do just that, it's called Courtroom Strategy and Procedure. Just call the law school, 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's 417-273-4967. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, educational, informative. It's free. Courtroom Strategy and Procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on to the email, send an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing a book here called Critical Condition, published just last year, November 2004, Doubleday, written by Donald Bartlett, B-A-R-L-E-T-T, and James Steele, S-T-E-E-L-E. I recommend the book, and I'm reviewing it for that purpose. I think you ought to read it. If I didn't think you ought to read it, then I wouldn't review it. These guys are telling you what I told you in the last program. You're being screwed, blued, and tattooed by the insurance industry. And that's not the only group that's screwing you, but you know, we tend to blame the doctors and the hospitals for these rising medical care costs. I showed you last time, 27% of the doctor's bill is just for the paperwork that he's sending you. On average, 27%. So your doctor could lower his prices by 27%. Your hospital could reduce their prices 27% if we just paid cash. Now, of course, you people are going to sit there and say, well, I can't afford to pay cash. Well, if you can afford to pay premiums of $10,000 a year, you can sure as hell afford to pay cash. And that's because the insurance company doesn't take $10,000 worth of premiums and then pay out $10,000, $12,000, or $15,000 in benefits. The insurance company takes in $10,000 in premiums and pays out $5,000 in benefits or less. In the auto insurance company business, they take in $10,000 and they pay out about $1,000. They make a $9,000 profit. In other words, insurance is an immensely profitable business. I don't know what the profitability is in health insurance. I was an insurance adjuster, but I didn't work in health insurance. I worked in auto. so I can tell you what autos are. In fact, the insurance companies complained bitterly. They said, my God, our claims have doubled over the last 20 or 30 years. And they did. When I was a kid, back in the 60s, just a wet behind the ears, pimply-faced punk kid working auto insurance, claims the auto insurance industry was paying out 5 cents for every dollar's worth of premiums they took in. 95% profit. Today they pay out 11 cents. 11 cents. I mean, it is true. Their costs have doubled. And I say, so what? Any company, any business that can make a 90% profit, you know, nine times the amount that you're taking in, you know, that's phenomenal. Jewelry, you know, has three keystones in it. You know, your local jeweler, he sells you a $1,000 ring. He paid $300 for it. Sold it to you for $1,000. Has three marks in it. Insurance has nine marks in it. Auto insurance. Now, I said last time I was going to tell you a story about old Emil Crow. This is a true-to-life story. Kind of old, 1950. But Emil Crow was an insurance adjuster. That's why we kind of hit it off. He was an attorney when I met him up in Boise, Idaho. But in 1950, he was an independent insurance adjuster working the southern tier counties of Missouri, that is, you know, across from Joplin over to the Boot Heel. I don't know, probably 10 counties for the Travelers Insurance Company. I don't know if he was an attorney in 1950, but he was a claims adjuster, and I think he was an attorney working out of his office doing both. And that's a pretty common practice. You know, if you're a national company and you don't have a lot of customers, you know, in a certain area, you don't have an insurance adjuster, you don't have any insurance offices in a particular location or area. So you go to the independent insurance adjusters, and that's what old Emil was. Well, sure enough, one of their insured had an accident. Now, he had a very large policy. For 1950, it was a pretty significant policy, $50,000. This is in the days when, you know, you had a $5,000 or $10,000 policy. This guy had a $50,000 policy, which would be about like having a $1 million policy today. It was a big policy, no doubt about it. Now, there's one thing that insurance companies do is they guard the amount of the policy limit. They guard that with their life. We would never reveal the policy limit to anybody, not even on discovery. And in federal practice and in most states, you can't find out what the policy limit is. So if you're suing an insurance company, you don't know if you're playing the game for $1 million or $50,000. You don't have any idea. So old Emil goes out, investigates the accident, and he comes back with a report, and he says, it's obvious that our insured is, in fact, responsible for the accident. Furthermore, in his report, he pointed out that $50,000 probably would not cover the damages. That probably the damages would exceed $50,000. Now, the insurance company doesn't care about that. The insurance company has a duty to defend, that is, the judicial defense of their insured, plus whatever they have on the contract policy or contracted in the policy, which in this case was $50,000. So let's suppose the case goes to trial, the jury comes back and awards $75,000. The insurance company pays $50,000, pays for the defense, and the insured has to come up with the other $25,000. But the way the insurance company pays these independent insurance adjusters is a percentage of what they save the company. For instance, if Emil Crow could settle this $50,000 claim for $25,000, then the insured would get $25,000, Emil would get $12,500, and Travelers would save $12,500 on the payout. So the incentive for the claims adjuster, see, if you're working on staff, you just get paid a salary per month. But if you're an independent, and this is where insurance adjusters like to get, they like to get to be an independent insurance adjuster, so they get a percentage of the action. Emil was one of those. And he got paid 50%, half, of whatever he saved on the claim. So he goes to the guy that's been damaged. He's in the hospital. This guy had been in the hospital for a couple of months, him and his wife. Didn't kill anybody, but they got banged up pretty bad. Cars are total out. This guy's off work. He's not working. And old Emil, he's a pretty affable kind of guy, and he says, "Hey, we owe you money. You're in safe hands with Travelers," and gives him the good spiel, and we'll take care of everything. And this takes the guy off guard. And he knows that the insurance company is going to pay his hospital bill, and at some point in time he's going to get paid for his time off work and so on. Well, Emil investigates the case a little bit. This guy starts writing him letters and says, "Hey, when are you going to pay us some money?" And as I recall, Emil did send him some money, you know, or he might not. I kind of forget how this went, whether he gave him some advances or not. But he came back after about 90 days. He stalls this guy off for about 90 days. He comes back and says, "We see contributory negligence here. And we're not going to pay you. We think that you're partly responsible for this accident. Now, we don't deny that we have some liability here, but we deny that we have 100% of the liability." So he says to this guy, "I'm authorized to pay you $7,000. Now, he's got a $50,000 policy he's working with. He says to this guy, "I'll pay you $7,000. They figured that if it went to trial, they would have to pay out over $50,000. He offers him a paltry $7,000. This is what we call a nuisance value settlement. We offer him this nuisance value. Take it or leave it. I'll give you $7,000. I'm authorized to settle it right now." This guy is so damn mad. You know, if he'd had a gun, he'd have probably shot Crow. It was an insult, no doubt about it. But it's a part of the negotiating strategy and technique of the insurance company. See, we know that we can't negotiate with you. We want you to go hire an attorney, because two sharks can converse and can do business a whole lot better than one shark with an adversary. So this guy goes out and hires an attorney. Now the attorney contacts Crow. Crow walks into the attorney's office and he says, "Well, okay. We think there's contributory negligence." This guy's attorney says, "Now you know that that's not true. I investigated the accident, and you know that you guys have 100% of the liability. Now why don't you pay off?" So Crow says to the lawyer. He says, "Well, how much are you getting paid here?" And he says, "Well, I'm going to get paid one third of what I settle with the insurance company with." So Crow goes out and plays golf with this guy, you know, and he dinks around for a while, and they're talking. And so Crow comes up to him and says, "Okay, now listen, let me tell you how this game's going to be played out. You know, as a fellow shark, a fellow attorney, that we're not going to tell you what the policy limits are. But I'm going to share with you. We're playing for $20,000. We got a pretty good settlement here. We got a $20,000 policy." And the lawyer says, "Well, you know, this thing could run $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 or more." And he said, and Crow told him, he said, "Well, yeah, that's true. But our limitation's $20,000. Now, if you want to go to litigation and you want to get more than the $20,000, that's up to you. But you know, we're stuck here at $20,000, and that's all we're going to pay. So we're going to offer you $17,000, and I got to get something out of this. I get paid by making recommendations. I will recommend to the Travelers that they cut a check for $17,000. That leaves $3,000 in the pot. I get $1,500, and the insurance company gets $15,000. You guys get $17,000. You get a third of the $17,000. Your client gets $11,000 and some change, and you get the balance. Go sell it to your client." So this guy's own attorney goes back to him and says, "Look, you should settle out of court, because if you go to trial, your chances of beating this insurance company aren't all that good. And even if you beat them, I happen to have privileged information. The policy limit's $20,000. And you're not going to get anything more out of this guy, because he's going to file for bankruptcy and bankrupt out of the balance. So all you're going to get paid is $20,000 if you win. But you can't get the whole 20 if you settle out of court. They'll settle for 17, pay me a third, and you get about 12. Now remember, Crow offered him 7, so now he's going to get an extra 5,000. So the guy says, okay, we guess we better settle. Because his attorney is leaning on him. So you got the insurance company leaning on you. And then here's what's worse. This thing is now dragged on for 6 months. This guy's been off work. His house is being foreclosed on, or has been. He's borrowing money from his friends and neighbors. His car has been totally wrecked. This guy is in financial distress, and this is part of the technique that insurance companies use. Government, the IRS, any lawyer knows that what we do is we stall this out, we drag it out to put you in financial distress so that there's more pressure on you to settle. And this guy settled for the $17,000. Now look at how the numbers come out. Policy limit isn't 20, it's 50. So the man who has been injured, and everybody that looked at the case said more than $50,000 gets paid 12. His attorney gets paid about 5 or 6, a third. Emil Crow gets to split half of $33,000 with the insurance company. He gets paid $16,500. Emil Crow, the insurance adjuster, gets paid more than the victim, for crying out loud. The insurance company saved $16,500. They got more out of the deal than the victim. Now, boys and girls, that's the usual, ordinary, run-of-the-mill way that insurance companies do business. So I just thought I'd share that with you. Now, let me tell you about critical condition. Now, this critical condition is exploring this very same thing. That's why they call the book Critical Condition. How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine. Donald L. Bartlett, Barlett, published by Doubleday and Company, 2004. New book. Just go to Barnes & Noble, tell them you want Critical Condition, Bartlett and Steele. Now, in the case of physicians, going on with our story from last time, a profession of individualists, where consensus is hard to come by, the billing nightmares resonate with everyone from primary care doctors to surgeons. An AMA survey in 2001 found that doctors regarded downcoding and bundling as impacting more on their practices than all but one other issue, and that's insurers' delays or denials of claims. I told you about that last time. We just deny the claim. Or we're going to stall you out and string this on because we're working on your money. Sure, doc, I owe you $8,000 on this billing that you put in. But if I can stall you off for 30 days on the $8,000 that I owe you, I'm collecting 10% divided by 360 times whatever days that I've got your money and can stall you off, and that's the name of the game. And when you're dealing with thousands of doctors and you're using millions and millions and probably billions of dollars, you know the profits that we make from these stalling and delaying tactics and this denial of claims is in the billions of dollars of profits that go right to our bottom lines. You know, like I said, you know, it's nothing personal, it's just business. Now, for more than 20 years, Dr. Michael Burgess delivered babies in Louisville, Texas, 20 miles north of Dallas. All through the 90s, his reimbursement rates eroded significantly while his overhead soared. Burgess said that he found it increasingly difficult to keep his office open and his staff paid. But hardest of all was to take was what was happening to his profession. The anxiety level, the frustration level of practicing medicine has gone through the roof. Burgess said in a court proceeding, if a young person came to me today and said, boy, I'd like to be a doctor. I'd like to be just like you. I'd say, I'm flattered. Go talk to a stockbroker or a lawyer. In 2002, Burgess took some of his own advice. He quit medicine. He ran for Congress and became a congressman representing the 26th District of Texas. And battles between physicians and insurance companies over reimbursements are an old story. But in recent years, the advantage has shifted overwhelmingly to the insurers, largely made possible by development of sophisticated computer programs that can automatically downcode, bundle, and otherwise reduce doctors' fees, and include insurance company profits. The most widely used medical claim software is ClaimCheck of McKesson Corporation, the healthcare giant that had 24,500 employees and revenue of $57 billion in 2003. The corporation has offices around the world, but few with more impact on physicians than a modern three-story brick building in western suburbs of Philadelphia. It was in a leafy office park in Malvern, Pennsylvania, that ClaimCheck was born 20 years ago, and from there, it continues to exercise ever greater influence on physician income. McKesson licenses ClaimCheck to health insurers who modify the program to fit their own claims-paying policies. Every year, it saves health insurers billions, money that comes straight out of the pockets of doctors. Mention ClaimCheck to a physician and you're likely to get an earful, if not a bloody nose. To many, it embodies everything that has gone wrong in medicine. A computer program that overrides medical decisions and dictates how much doctors can earn. McKesson says that ClaimCheck only corrects coding errors and collars cheating doctors. Physicians see it differently. I call it fraud against doctors, says Texas gynecologist Dr. David E. Rogers. Ironically, the software that has made doctors miserable was inspired by a doctor. His name was Elmer R. Gabrilli. He was a Buffalo pathologist with an interest in computers, and he began tinkering with programming back in the 70s to translate doctors' notes into computer terms. So in 1984, Dr. Gabrilli and his son Christopher founded GMIS, its Gabrilli Medical Information Systems. The company soon became a pace setter in the emerging field known as automated medical management. The Gabrillis quickly realized that there wasn't much money to be made peddling software to doctors, so they switched to what one Wall Street analyst called the payer side of the healthcare equation, the insurance companies. The breakthrough year was 1989 when GMIS introduced ClaimCheck. ClaimCheck, a revolutionary new product that automatically identifies and corrects billing errors that can inflate physician payments. With insurers increasingly intent on cutting costs, ClaimCheck seemed heaven sent. It was a way to systematically reduce payments to doctors. GMIS saw itself as an agent to control health spending, albeit at the expense of the doctors. In annual reports, the company spoke of preventing unnecessary care, eliminating inappropriate payments, and identifying patterns of inefficiency, as well as eliminating inefficient providers and preventing physicians from providing expensive, unwarranted procedures. Well, I don't know about you, Doc, but I've had a number of doctors and other healthcare providers come through my business school, and I think every single one of them, as far as I can tell, has been successful in cutting himself loose from the insurance debacle or the insurance companies pilfering of doctors' fees. So if you're one of those healthcare providers, why don't you give us a call and let's talk about this thing of our business school. How do you do business without insurance? How do you do business without insurance? Cut the insurance company out. It takes about 1 year to convert your practice or your business, whatever it might be, off of insurance and onto something else. You have to shift your customer base. You have to give your customers incentives. You devise incentives to give to your customers. And you say, customer, if you want insurance, here's the price. If you want to pay us with credit card, here's the price. You want to pay us in cash, here's the price. You want to pay in gold, here's the price. And all of a sudden, you know, customers aren't stupid. You know, they look at that and say, God, that guy over there is paying 17 to 30% less than I'm paying. How do I get that same discount, Doc? Well, here, we got to eliminate the insurance company. We got to eliminate the government bureaucracy. That's the way that's done. Well, ClaimCheck was an immediate success. GMIS turned a profit the year it came on the market and recorded progressively higher earnings. Within 3 years, the company had licensed the software to more than 100 health insurers, including some of the nation's largest, like Aetna, Humana, and Cigna. The rewards were awesome. For an annual licensing fee of $325,000, Aetna said it reaped $24 million in annual savings. In 1991, GMIS went public and investors snapped up the shares, making the beginning of a rapid rise in the company's stock price. Wall Street was enthusiastic. Fundamentally, we like GMIS, wrote an analyst for Robinson Humphrey Company in 1993. GMIS' focus on the healthcare market has clearly paid off. Revenues have risen at a rate of 55% since 1989. Operating income growth has exceeded 43% every year. We believe that GMIS is clearly well situated to continue its rapid growth. GMIS was sold in 1996 to a larger public company, HBO & Company. That's an Atlanta-based vendor of computer systems for hospitals and doctors. It was sold for $220 million. 2 years later, HBO & Company was acquired by McKesson, that's a drug company. Except for doctors, just about everyone involved with GMIS has done well. The original investors profited. The GMIS acquisition helped make HBO & Company an inviting takeover target for a larger company. And ClaimCheck solidified McKesson's position in the healthcare technology field. Now, as for the Gabriellis, the family earned millions from the software. Christopher Gabrielli became a successful venture capitalist in Boston as a partner in one of the nation's oldest private venture capital firms. Bessemer Venture Partners, with some of the money that he made from the GMIS and other companies. He dabbled in politics. In 1998, while seeking the Democratic nomination for the Boston congressional seat, being vacated by Joseph P. Kennedy II, Gabrielli latched on to a hot issue with voters, anger toward HMOs. In a series of slick advertisements and campaign speeches, Gabrielli pounded away at HMO abuses. See to it that you and your doctors, not HMO accountants, decide what's best, urged one ad. Gabrielli said his polling showed that voters liked the idea that he could help them fight medical bureaucracies. The Boston Herald called him the poster boy for HMO hatred. Gabrielli seemed untroubled that his former company, GMIS, had done much to foster practices that were now stirring that hatred. When a Boston Globe reporter asked if he saw any conflict between his stance attacking HMOs and the role of his entrepreneurial company, and how it had played an empowering role in their billing practices, Gabrielli answered that the charge was baseless. The software behind the current controversial billing practices of HMOs, he insisted, was different from that developed when he was associated with GMIS. Gabrielli eventually spent an estimated $5 million of his own money before his bid for Congress failed. Let me pause here for a moment. Let me point something out. Why would a guy want to spend $5 million of his own money for a job that pays less than $100,000 a year? Now, I might be wrong about that, but it seems like to me that these congressmen make around $100,000 a year, don't they? I mean, hell, the president makes $400,000. So, here's a guy that's going to spend $5 million on a job. And this job is going to get him what? $100,000 a year for 2 years. He's going to get $200,000 worth of money from the government, eh? And he's going to spend $5 million of his own money to get that job. What does that tell you? It sure as hell not economical. Doesn't that guy want the power that goes with that position? Power? Power to do what? Power. Yeah. So the politicians get into office and then they get paid off by these lobbying companies. You know, it could be in the insurance industry or others. And then when he comes out of that job, he'll go to work, you know, for some outside firm, you know, like Pfizer or some drug company or something else. Remember, he's a doctor. You know, like I said before, boys and girls, it's nothing personal. It's just money. Well, we're at the halfway point here. Let me give you a reminder, and we'll take a look at long-distance diagnosis. So here's where we can get you diagnosed from Bangladesh or India. You're listening to The Law. We're an editorial review heard by millions around the world on the Internet and over many radio stations worldwide. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, area code 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to the authors and publishers and publications on this program. Often we endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or the publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on this Law Hour program are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review, or vice versa. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network, or of the local radio station that you're listening to. So for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or call direct 417-273-4967. Tonight's report is called Critical Condition, written by Donald Bartlett and James Steele, published by Doubleday of New York. It's a high recommendation. Not necessarily a must read. I score books, you know, on run-of-the-mill books, you know, a 1 in 20 book. Old Solomon made an observation. He said, of the writing of books, there is no end. This is about a 1 in 20 read. It's not a 1 in 100. There are a lot of books out there in the marketplace that deal with medicine and the chicanery that goes on out there. But this is one of those 1 in 20. You'll read 20 before you'll find a good one like this. And I've already reviewed it, and I'm recommending it. I don't know what the price is. The wife buys these books, and I imagine it's $20-$30. But if it's a $30 book, it's worth all of the $30. Now, a generation ago, your personal health care decisions, a medical appointment, a prescription, a test, a recommendation for a specialist, flowed through your doctor's office and through your doctor's hands. Your physician decided whether you would have a procedure. Your physician decided whether you would be admitted to the hospital. Your doctor decided how long you would stay in the hospital. Now, to cut costs, the insurance companies took much of that power away from the doctors and gave it to the health care call center. Now, here in their lexicon was a way to manage care. That is a buzzword for managing cost cutting, which really meant to restrict and to deny medical care. The length of stay guidelines and then the coding schemes were but tools that the insurance companies have used to achieve that end. The call center became the command post to carry it all out. So since then, hundreds of call centers have popped up all across America. They employ thousands of workers. A few of these workers are located in or near big cities, but most are in medium-sized communities or small towns. Often, they are in areas where jobs are hard to come by, thereby enabling owners to hold down wages and still attract grateful workers. Bismarck, North Dakota, hosts some of the healthcare industry's largest centers. In towns like Visalia in Central California, the call center is the largest employer in the little town of Visalia. For many Americans, these centers are perhaps the most infuriating symbol of American healthcare. The chief function of these faceless people who answer these telephones seems to be to see how long callers can be kept on hold, or how many times they can be compelled to call again and again and again before securing a satisfactory answer to their question. These call centers, housed in warehouse-like buildings, the centers sit anonymously alongside interstate highways or sequestered in featureless office parks. The interiors of these places don't look like they have anything to do with medicine, and indeed, they do not. They have to do with insurance, billing, and payments. And the workforce could just as easily be filling orders for L.L. Bean. Now imagine an empty Walmart store lined with row after row of cubicles, each separated by a low partition. These partitions stretch in every direction as far as the eye can see. Now inside of each pod is a compact workspace with a computer terminal and an operator. Usually it will be a woman. She will be wearing a telephone headset. Rising above this vast grid of squares is the constant sound of phones ringing and people talking and computer keys clicking. In some centers, the sound goes on 24 hours a day. As these calls stream in, they are randomly routed to operators. If a caller complains of a medical problem, the operator asks a series of pre-programmed questions. Where is the pain or discomfort? When did it start? How intense is it? Have you had it before? Who is your primary care physician? Now, these questions may give callers the impression that they're speaking to someone who is well-versed in medicine. But most of these operators are simply reading questions that appear on their computer screens and then keying in the answers. These people may have been working down at the local feed store last week or last month. They have nothing at all to do with medicine. These operators rely on software programs called scripts that offer up standardized queries about various ailments and injuries, allowing people with absolutely no medical training whatsoever to diagnose these conditions that were once solely the responsibility of doctors. In theory, a caller who has a serious medical problem will be turned over to a nurse or a physician. But that decision rests entirely with this operator, often a low-paid, minimum-wage worker who is brand new to the job. And turnover is extremely high. And wages are extremely low. Now, for many of these call center employees, their only training is mechanical and rudimentary. How to answer the telephone, how to use the computer, how to access the scripts, how to input the caller's answers, and how to make a referral. A good telephone manner is a plus, but it's not essential. What the industry requires most is warm bodies to answer an ever-growing tidal wave of telephone calls. And although these workers have become crucial cogs in the healthcare bureaucracy, they rank at the bottom of the industry's hierarchy. When insurers cut their budgets, they're among the first to go. People hired 1 month are often laid off a few months later, and sometimes long-standing employees are terminated only to see their jobs filled by new hires at lower pay in India or some other foreign country. These call centers are essentially factories, today's equivalent of yesterday's assembly lines, tethered to telephones all day and fielding an endless stream of inquiries, appeals for help, billing questions and requests for referrals, prescription refills and doctor's appointments, all the while under pressure to move on quickly to the next waiting call. Workers are such, like their predecessors in textile mills at the dawn of industrialization. The surroundings may be cleaner, better lighted, and less noisy, but they're every bit as regimented and just as stressful. The work is intense. On any given day, an operator handles dozens of calls from worried and angry patients and physicians asking why a referral didn't come through, or why a patient had to pay such a large percentage of a medical bill, or why a physician wasn't reimbursed for full or in full for some procedure. Doctors become livid when they talk about the amount of time they waste on the phone with clerks who, after consulting their computer screens, refuse to grant a referral or authorize a test because they deem the physician's request to be medically unnecessary. And who is it that is determining that this doctor's request is medically unnecessary? Oh, this person may have been a secretary or a cleaning lady or a janitor last week or last month, or may not even be a citizen of the United States, may just be a worker in Bangladesh or India, making these kinds of medical decisions. Now, call center workers are the health plan's gatekeepers who restrict and ration the care by saying no to patients and doctors alike. Technically, they are customer service representatives, but usually their work is just exactly the opposite. Their job is to discourage care, discourage tests, and discourage procedures, and to reduce and or delay the reimbursements. Now, is this what you want to buy? Is this what you want to buy into with your national health care insurance? Is this the kind of health care that you want? Because this is the kind of health care that you have, boys and girls. These operators are under enormous pressure to minimize the time that they spend talking on the telephone or processing claims with you. Those who take longer than average are reprimanded and then threatened with dismissal, says an employee at one California operation. They will say, "Now, what is the problem here? You know how long you're supposed to be on the telephone." In this job, she says, the fear of spending too much time with a patient is always hanging over your head. The briefer the calls, of course, the more calls that can be fielded, which means fewer employees and more for the bottom line. One healthcare consultant says, if you measure this by the number of calls they have to make, these are sweatshops. Now, unlike the chronic repetition of assembly line work, healthcare calls are anything but predictable. Rarely is a healthcare call one exactly like the one that just preceded it. Many require individual attention, and some cannot be swiftly resolved. What happens if you get stuck with calls that are difficult, that take the most time? Asks the consultant. Well, all of a sudden you say to the caller, I have to get off now. I'm taking too much time. Call back later. Bye. Healthcare companies deny that they have quotas, but there isn't much doubt that they impose performance targets on their employees. Indianapolis-based Anthem Incorporated, they're the fourth largest publicly traded health benefits company with revenue of $13 billion in 2002, implemented one such program in the late 1990s. Formerly a privately held mutual insurer in Indiana, Anthem went national in the 1990s and acquired nonprofit Blue Cross and Blue Shield affiliates, converting them to profit-making enterprises. Today, its Blues provide health insurance for more than 12.5 million Americans in 9 states. Colorado, Connecticut, Indiana, Kentucky, Maine, Nevada, New Hampshire, Ohio, and Virginia. When a planned merger with WellPoint Health Networks is completed, Anthem will be the nation's largest health benefits company, providing coverage for 28 million Americans in 13 states. Now, while positioning itself to go public, Anthem sought to make the company more attractive to investors by cutting costs and promoting efficiencies. To reduce payments to doctors, the company rigorously tracked the work of its call center claims agents, as later spelled out in a lawsuit filed by Connecticut physicians with information provided by whistleblowers inside the company. Utilization and claims personnel were instructed by Anthem that certain targets and goals were established for utilization of healthcare services. So if a specific target was not met, a supervisor responsible for overseeing the particular claims personnel would be reprimanded by senior management and warned that there would be serious ramifications if a particular target was not met the following month. Conversely, call center workers who met their targets were rewarded, reportedly with bonuses of up to 25% of their salaries. So Connecticut doctors later sued, charging that Anthem was interested in financial benchmarks without regard for individual medical needs. Okay, so what else is new? Remember that lady? The lady in San Leandro, California? Remember this lady? Her name was Utterback. The lady that called the call center. Remember, she was a Kaiser patient for 50 years. Utterback had been dealing with the health plan's clinics for decades. However, the call she made that morning did not go to the clinic that she had used for years. It was automatically forwarded to another location. A location, the Kaiser Call Center, that had taken over the task of scheduling doctor's appointments and dealing with other medical matters that were previously handled by the clinics. So when Mrs. Utterback called, she got hold of not a doctor, not a nurse, not a healthcare professional. She got hold of a former hair care dresser, or secretary, or welfare mother. And it was this call center employee, this minimum wage call center employee, that made the life or death decision as to whether Mrs. Utterback was going to get to see a doctor or not, which ultimately cost her her life, which is the point of this book. Did you know that? Did you know that when you call for a doctor on your health care plan, you may be talking to somebody in India or Bangladesh or God knows where, who's going to make the life and death decision as to whether or not you should see a doctor today or not. And she's going to look this up on a pre-programmed computer that's going to tell her what are the statistical odds of you actually having a medical emergency right now. And remember, all of these medical emergencies are programmed in the best case scenarios. Take 2 aspirins and call back in the morning. Now, I've read this book and I've read other books along the line, and I came to the conclusion, not me, not little Georgie Gordon. So I went in and I talked to a doctor and I said, "Hey, doc, I pay cash and I pay in gold and I don't need a receipt. And if I called you, what are the chances of getting in here?" I don't call call centers. I'm not interested in insurance or making some score. I'm just interested in buying the services that I want. The doctor that I deal with is going to be paid. He's going to be paid in full. He's going to be paid by me, and he's going to be paid in gold coin if he wants it. Hell, I'll pay him in Russian rubles if that's what he wants. I don't care. But I don't want my life, my health, or my health care determined by some nameless, faceless worker, some minimum work, minimum wage jerk in Bangladesh or India, or Visalia, California, deciding whether I live or die, so that they can enhance the profit margin of Aetna or Sitka or somebody else. And that's just me. Now, in Northern California, Kaiser Permanente dangled similar incentive bonuses before clerks to keep calls brief. And in a plan implemented at three large centers in Sacramento, San Jose, and Vallejo, California in 2000, Kaiser promised, according to the Los Angeles Times, to reward their clerks with upwards of a 10% salary bonus if they accomplished three of four objectives. Number one, handle regular calls in less than 3 minutes and 45 seconds. Two, schedule or request appointments for patients in no more than 15% to 35% of cases. Three, transfer fewer than 50% of calls to nurses for additional help. And four, spend an average of 75% of more of the workday answering calls. Now look at number two and three. The insurance company, now Kaiser is a health care plan. It's an insurance health care plan. They've got hospitals and they provide the insurance. They want to maximize their profits. So they go to the call center and they say, okay, let's suppose you get a call from little Georgie Gordon and he's got a pain in his side. And here's what I want you to do. I'll give you a 10% bonus if you can keep this conversation with Gordon down to 3 minutes and 45 seconds or less. Hell, it might take me 4 or 5 minutes to describe the problem. But this guy on the other end isn't going to let me spend 3 minutes and 45 seconds because he's motivated by making an extra 10% bonus, and he's sure as hell not going to let me get in the way of his bonus next Friday. Second, notice that if he can schedule or request appointments for patients in no more than 15% to 35% of cases. So, I probably need a doctor, I probably need a healthcare professional, but he's going to get a 10% bonus if he can keep me from seeing a doctor. Whether I need a doctor or not, this minimum wage worker is going to, for his 10% bonus, he's going to make sure that I don't see a doctor, if it's at all possible. And then look at number three. If he needs help, he has to transfer me to a doctor or a nurse for additional help. Listen, if he can do that in less than half of the cases, that is, transfer fewer than 50% of calls to nurses for additional help, that means, hey, listen, I'm not a medical professional, and I don't know anything about medicine, and maybe I can't answer this question, but if I can't answer the question, I'm supposed to transfer you to a nurse, who in turn is going to transfer you to a doctor if she can't answer the question. But in this case, I get a 10% bonus by not transferring your call to a nurse. So I'm going to do everything in my power to avoid sending you to a real medical professional, and if I can keep from scheduling you with a doctor in more than 35% of the cases, and if I can handle your call in 3 minutes and 45 seconds. Now listen, boys and girls, I'm going to do just exactly that. It's nothing personal, but, you know, money's money. Now, did you want your health care in the hands of somebody that's not even a nurse, a doctor, or a professional? Now look, the government is after quacks. I mean, if you got some guy over here that's practicing medicine without a license, maybe this guy actually knows something about medicine. We'll lock that kook up in prison. But here are the people that actually determine whether or not you're going to see a doctor or not. This is the guy in between. This guy works for the insurance company like old Emil Crow. His job is to line his own pockets. We're not concerned about your medical problem. Now, how do you like that, boys and girls? Now remember, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I'm only covering some of the high points in a book called Critical Condition. Critical Condition, written by Donald Bartlett and James Steele, published by Doubleday of New York. Critical Condition, the name of the book. Donald Bartlett, Doubleday. Go to Barnes & Noble and get a copy today. It'll blow your socks off. So I pointed out to you, I said, hell, I wouldn't pay $10,000. I wouldn't pay the insurance industry 50 cents on a box top. Not for this kind of crap. These people are medical quacks. This is quackery at its ultimate level. Hell, these guys can't even qualify as quacks. Quacks actually have some medical knowledge. Hell, I would rather go to a quack than one of these kooks. Think about that. In a year's time, an aggressive clerk could earn a bonus of $2,500 by keeping talk to a minimum and referring fewer callers to physicians and nurses. Yeah, you call up and, my God, I've got this pain and I'm sick, and I'm sitting here saying, God, you're going to interfere with my $2,500 bonus, dummy. I'm not going to refer you to a doctor or a nurse. Take two aspirins and go to bed. Now, Kaiser maintained that the program was to promote good service, but it sparked outrage among Kaiser's call center nurses, who believed that it encouraged untrained clerks to make medical decisions that might harm patients. Well, duh. Hell, Kaiser's in business to make money, and the clerks are in business to make their $2,500 bonus. After 2 years, Kaiser abandoned the experiment, saying that it wasn't working. But Kaiser's long-range strategy, like that of most HMOs and insurers, is still to shift more work to lower-paid clerks with no specialized medical knowledge. These people you're talking to on the phone might just as well be your 17-year-old high school senior, who might actually be more competent than these jerks that are called clerks working for the insurance company who are motivated by a $2,500 bonus. Such is the case of Kaiser's Vallejo Call Center in San Francisco's East Bay off Interstate 80 in a nondescript building that resembles a warehouse. Several hundred call center representatives answer telephones around the clock. More than half have no medical training whatsoever. The rest are registered nurses with years of experience treating patients. Many of the calls that stream in are routine. Requests for the name of a specialist, the location of a clinic, or a duplicate health care card. Yet even some calls that might appear routine can require a medical decision. Catherine Eldson has seen this firsthand. She's an advice nurse at Vallejo. Eldson has been a registered nurse for nearly 30 years, working primarily with oncology patients. In 1999, feeling burned out because she could no longer provide good care in understaffed hospitals, she went to work at Kaiser's recently opened Vallejo Center. Outgoing and gregarious, Eldson felt the call center would let her stay in touch with patients, which she enjoyed in a setting much less stressful than the hospital floor. But at Vallejo, she and other nurses have encountered a different kind of stress. All incoming calls first go to clerks who decide whether they should be transferred to one of the registered nurses for further evaluation. Well, isn't that just special? And as they follow the queries on their computer screens, the clerks attempt to assess each caller's condition. But in the minds of Kaiser's nurses, this is risky business. What the hell do these people know about medicine? Clerks unable to recognize the nuances of a caller's symptoms may miss a serious health problem that a nurse would be a whole lot more likely to pick up. This is where I am most anxious about what I do, said Eldson. Patients don't always know how serious their condition is when they should see a doctor right away, and they're being diagnosed by mere clerks. It's worse than quackery. I'm out of time. We'll have to leave it right there, boys and girls, but we'll be back tomorrow night with more on Critical Condition, written by Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Remember, you can get a copy. Barnes & Noble, published by Doubleday of New York. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website, remember, at georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package to order yours. Please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Okay, time's up. See you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.